We'd like to just start with a word of prayer before we begin. Dear Heavenly Father, we just thank you for this privilege of sharing our experiences in Haiti with these people, and we just pray your blessing on this time together as we think about the people in this part of the world that we know you care about and want to help. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, first of all, we wanted to share with you a little bit about ourselves and how we happened to be in Haiti. We don't claim to be experts about Haiti, and we don't know all there is about Haiti. We're not experts about political situation, so it is a fairly complicated country, and there are many things that you find out in Haiti that are not what you thought they might be, and its situations are more complicated than meet the eye many times. I'm a general practitioner, and Wanda's an LPN. Our home is Arlington, Washington. We've been married 3 years, and it was 1988 that we spent a little part of our courtship here in Holden Village before we got married, and so we have pleasant memories of this place. We have been exposed to Haiti, became exposed mainly through an organization called Haiti Medical Teams. This is an organization that sends teams of about 25 people, usually about 3 doctors and a number of nurses, to set up medical clinics in a rural area of Haiti where the medical need is very great. These teams go out 2 or 3 teams a year, and I became involved with this organization first in 1984, and went out on a team, and went on 6 teams before we finally went to work full time. Wanda has been on two of those teams. These teams are really a great experience. There's a community kind of a life, somewhat like here in Holden Village, everybody sharing together and supporting each other and working as a team with a common goal, and the goal being to minister to the needs of the Haitian people. And it's a real eye-opener to most of the people that go on these teams to see what Haiti is like and to be exposed to the needs of these people. Many of these people have gone on these teams end up going back for additional times. It is a very, very meaningful experience, and I'd say half of the people end up going back on another team experience. And I think what percent of the people have been on these teams have ended up working full-time.
30%, they did a calculation.
Close to 30% have ended up going to work
full-time missions.
In missions full-time in some part of the world. And so it has a real impact on your life. So that's how we became introduced to the Haitian people and to Haiti. And we felt God was calling us to work full-time in Haiti, and went in July of 1990. We were forced to leave in November of 1991, so we didn't spend quite a year and a half there before we had to leave. We went to work in a little town of Dessalines, which is about 90 miles north of Port-au-Prince. It's about the close to the middle part of Haiti. There is a hospital that we work in there that has about 25 beds. There's a project called the Dessalines Rural Health Project that was started by the same person that, a doctor named Dan Morris, who started Haiti Medical Teams. And there was, it was felt that there was a need for a full-time, year-round presence in this area of Haiti. It's difficult to go there 2 weeks out of the year and see people suffering and to go off and leave them without really being concerned about providing some sort of medical care year-round. So out of this concern, the Dessalines Rural Health Project was started, and the hospital was opened in 1986. It's not easy running a hospital in a place like Haiti, and there are many problems that are, we encounter there. When you go to a place like Haiti, people often ask, why are you going there? The need is so great. There's so many people starving in the world and so many people without medical care. How can you really impact that? And it's questions like this. And we heard a little story from another team member on one of our Haiti medical team experiences. And the story went like this. There was this boy that was walking along the shore and was throwing starfish into the ocean. And this man came up and he saw this boy doing this, and he said to him, why are you doing that? The ocean is full with starfish. What difference does it make if a few starfish get washed up on the shore and die? And the boy that he was talking with picked up a starfish and he looked at it, and before he threw it back in, it matters to this one, and he threw it back into the ocean. And we feel that each person that you touch, it matters to them. You may not do a lot to change the world situation, but you know you're doing something, and God is using you to touch lives, individual lives. And so that being the case, I thought we would share you some stories about individuals that we've become acquainted with in our experiences in Haiti. And as we share about these individuals, it might help you better to understand how what is like in Haiti and some of the medical needs and so forth. Haiti has been said to be the poorest.
Excuse me, I got Haiti here.
Okay. Thanks for going, looking that up. Haiti's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. The average salary is something like $200 or $300 a year. There's something like 6.5 million people that live in Haiti. The infant mortality rate, or I've heard figures like something like 25% of the children will die before they reach 5 years of age. That the there's so many illnesses that our children succumb to that only 75% of children will make it past 5 years of age. 25% will die. So it's a very common thing for children to die, and this is something that seldom happens in America. Children usually are healthy, and it's an unusual thing for a child to die, and so this is hard to accept and to when you are working in Haiti and you encounter this, and it's very difficult. The first story I want to tell you about is about a small child named Wizzy. The second team I was on that I went to Haiti in 1985, we were working in clinic, and it was, I think, the second day of this team, which worked for 2 weeks. This small child was carried in and was placed on the exam table in front of me by Warren Land, who is a missionary in Haiti that was acting as interpreter for us. And he had tears in his eyes as he showed me this child. This child was 19 months old and weighed 8 pounds and was just skin and bones. It was just really sad. And probably was within a day or two of dying of starvation. The mother had become very ill with a severe dysentery, and she was unable to nurse the child. Her breast dried up, and she didn't have milk. And they were very poor. They had really no formula, no milk to give her. I suppose they gave her rice water or what little milk the mother had. And so this had gone on for some 6 months after the mother had become ill, that the child had just steadily gotten sicker and sicker, and was having diarrhea and was very, very sick when we saw the child, just gasping, wasn't able to even sit up. And it was a real sad situation. And what are we going to be able to do coming there for a couple weeks dealing with a child like this? This child needed to be in the hospital with very intensive care to pull through. And long term, how are we going to really be able to help this child? And I shared that story with the team that night. We would meet together and share our experiences during the day, and you know how it really bothered me seeing this child, and it just seemed like we weren't able to do much to help. Warren Land shared with us, he being the in-country missionary, that he said, "Jerry, well, you do what you can, and God will bless." And he shared a story about another child like this several years before, that one of the doctors had handed to his wife and said, "If you don't take this child home, this child's going to die." They ended up taking the child home to care for the child for a time, and it ended up that the parents became converted, and the father is now a pastor in one of our churches. And so he said that sometimes when it seems hopeless, you still do what you can and God will bless. And so we went on trying to help this child. We'd have the mother bring the child back every day. We were sending home formula. And one of the doctors went home to check and found that the other children at home were pretty bad shape too, and they were giving the formula to the other kids and weren't giving any of it to Wizzy, and because they figured she was a lost cause anyway. And so at that point, we kept her in the clinic throughout the day, and we had to put an NG tube into her stomach and keep a drip going throughout the day to feed her, and because she was too weak to swallow even. And we did this throughout the first week. Her strength started coming back, and she was able to sit up and drink out of a cup by the time we were leaving. And we did send her home with the Lands, and they took care of her, and she just really flourished. She just really did great. And after 3 months, she'd, I think, something like tripled her weight. And some money was found to help the family. They were just squatters that were living by the roadside. They didn't have any property and didn't really have just a banana leaf lean-to shelter that they were living in. Very poor. And the church built them a little house, and some property was found where they could plant a garden. And after Wizzy got better, she was returned to the family, and I've gone back every year since that on medical teams, and then we visited as we've been in country. It's been really exciting seeing how that family has been changed. The mother was very depressed. They had no future. This one child was dying, the others were sick, and it was just really exciting to see the mother. It was surprising to me. I was just as excited seeing the change in the mother as the change in Wizzy the next year when we came back, because the mother was just so happy and bubbling, and she was so depressed the year before. And We've sponsored one of the other children in the family. This is, the name of the family is the Rigaud family. And for them to go to school, they have to pay so much to attend schools there. There isn't public education. And there's a sponsorship program to help provide education for kids in this area, and we've been involved in. And it's been just really exciting to follow this family and to go back and see Wizzy as she's growing. And just the cutest little girl now. She's about 8. And her brothers and sisters, and to follow this family. And what was a hopeless situation at the outset, it was really exciting to see how God blessed and brought about changes. But life isn't easy in Haiti, and we were very saddened to find out that the mother died in 1989. The mother died of tuberculosis. We felt very badly about that, because we would come once a year for these medical teams, and in between teams she had come down with tuberculosis and no care was available, and she had died during between times. And so the older daughter was left to help care for the other children. She was only 12, and the father he was in busy, his job was selling hats. He made hats and sold them. But in spite of this, the kids, we've been following them since then, the last several years, and they've still been doing well, and there have been a lot of people have tried to help out, and it's exciting to see how, in spite of the problems they face, they're making it. I wanted to share a little bit about several other people. I'm finding I'm going on longer than I intended. I want to leave Wanda a chance to talk. I'll tell about one other person, and I'll let her share some things. One of the teams we were on, there was a man named Estevan that we met. We were having a little gathering in a circle like this, starting off the day with a devotional time. And this man came running into the circle holding a large rock in his hand. And he tripped and fell down on the ground right in front of me. And it was obvious that he wasn't quite right. And apparently he was a schizophrenic or had some kind of mental problems that he had. And all the kids would make fun of him and throw rocks at him. But he fell down on the ground right in front of me in the circle. And I reached down and held onto the rock and asked him to let go. And he let go of the rock, and he got up and left. And during the time we were there, the team showed him a love all the time and accepted him, and made the children stop throwing rocks at him. And when it came time for us to leave, we drove off in several vans, and he wanted to go home with us. And he ran behind our vans for about a half of a mile. And I think about everybody had tears coming down their faces as we were driving away. And it just really helped us realize that how much everyone needs to be loved and cared for, and how God cares about each of us. And it's easy sometimes when a person is not all there to think maybe when they're not acting sanely, that they're not a normal person. But everyone needs love, and It was a very meaningful experience with this man. We prayed for him while we were there, and we went back the following year, and we didn't get to see him, but the pastor said that he understands that he's not crazy anymore, that he's acting normally now. So those are just a couple of little anecdotes I wanted to share with you about people that we've ministered to. I'll let Wanda to share with you, and we'll talk more about maybe some of the political things that are going on in Haiti.
What I want to do is introduce you to a lady in our neighborhood, and through an introduction of her, her lifestyle, and her family, and where she lives, and so on, I hope to maybe tell you a little bit about Haitian life for a good majority of the people. Her name is Voisin, which in Creole means neighbor. That's what everybody calls her. Her given name is Santilia, but everybody calls her Voisin. Voisin is a lady of approximately, she's in her early 30s. It's very difficult to tell ages on the Haitian people. They don't show it as we do. Voisin has three children. The oldest is Regle, who is about 7, I think, now. Marie-Olaine is next, and then Limem, which in Creole means himself. Regle has one father. Marie-Olaine and Limem have a different father. She is currently living with the father to the two younger children, and in a house that also serves for the mother-in-law. There are cousins, nephews, that type of relatives that also live in this house. It's a two-room mud house. It's made from sticks, small poles that are sort of woven like so, and then mud put over that. If she had the money, she would love to have some cement and sand where she could make a thin coat to put over the mud so that when the rains came, it wouldn't wash her walls away. When we first came, she had a roof of tash, which is straw, rice straw usually, bundled together and anchored up on there. The rice straw, the tash, becomes very moldy and wet with the rains. Rats live in them. The rats come down at night and can nibble on the children's toes and ears. She brought me into her house one day as I was walking up the hill from the hospital going to our apartment, and she asked me to come in. And I went into her home, and she had a chair and a cot, a bed. There was a cloth dividing the two rooms, and I don't know what furniture or what was in the back room. There was a small, very small little table area. And she set me down and told me to look up at the roof, and there were holes just all over in her roof. Many of them had pieces of clothing stuffed in them, rags, anything she could to try and keep the rain out. She expressed her desire for me to help her get a new roof, because when the rains came, and the rainy season was going to be coming fairly soon, everything she owned in the house became soaked. And in the rainy season, when you have rain, you have it almost every afternoon, and it dumps. And it can be very devastating to go around and have the only few clothes you have that are soaking wet, and the winds come a little bit with that, and it makes it cold. Voisin, to try and make money to feed her family. I never did really understand where the father to these children. I didn't see him around. I think at a later point, a much later point, I got the impression that he was up in the hills part of the time trying to work land. Part of the time he may have been gone to Port-au-Prince, he may have been gone to other places. He was not around for the majority of the time to help her with the family. But Voisin gets buckets that are about 5-gallon buckets, I think, big plastic buckets that they sell a lard-type material in the market. And she sells water in the market out of these buckets. She gets up at about 4 in the morning and goes down and prepares her little spot in the marketplace, in the open-air market, and that's 2 days a week. She carries these large buckets of water down to the market, and usually she'll have a couple of them. If she had the money, sometimes she did, most of the time she did not, she would try to buy a chunk of glaz or ice to put in the water to keep it cold, because people bought cold water much more quickly than they bought hot water, which it would become hot after sitting in the sun. She had two sizes of cups, large and small. The small one was 2 cents and the large one was 4 cents for a cup of water. And she sold that water to the people who came from out of town on their burros and on foot and did their marketing there and their buying. And they did not have a place in town. They didn't have a house or any place to go and get water. So she was, that was her concession stand, so to speak. And off of that, by the time she paid for the water to fill the buckets, and if she bought ice, she did good if she'd make $3 or $4. And that was pretty good, and I don't think she did that much of the time. But that was her attempt to make commerce, as they call it. One day, her children have become sort of special to us, and every so often they're up in our house and we give them something to eat, juice and peanut butter and bread or leftover beans and rice or whatever we have. Or they're just, they're in our yard and they're always walking up and down the hill with us. They've become special. But one day I was walking down the hill with Regley and Marie Olaine, and I was after rain, and I was talking about the rain that came last night, and oh, wasn't it wonderful, and how I just loved it when the rain came, because it clears the air out of all the dust and the dirt, and it makes such a fresh smell. And they both told me, no, they didn't like the rain. And I said, well, why don't you like the rain? And they said, well, it comes in our house and everything gets wet. We don't like the rain. And I kind of, ooh, that's a little different slant on it. So that always made me think, when the rains came, I always think about the people on the hill behind me who live in the mud huts and how the rain comes. And perhaps they have the holes from the mud washing out, or the holes in the Tosh roof. Puts a different perspective on things that I'd liked. Sure, it's very contrary to American culture and to, I think in a lot of ways, to Christianity and things that we take for granted as being American culture, but really are Judeo-Christian ethics from way back. Friendship is always kind of held cautiously because of the expectations. An expectation of a friendship from a Haitian person versus what we expect out of friendship is different. And on one side of the coin, you don't like to be in reserve when you want to be somebody's friend. You want to really be their friend. But on the other side of the coin, if their expectations for that friendship are different than you expect, then that friendship is bound to have some clashes and some problems. It's very desirable to be a friend to a foreigner, a missionary, a white person, anybody who has more money than you do. Because in Haitian culture, a friend always helps. A friend will always give you whatever they have. And if you're not aware of that, then when you become friends with a Haitian person, be prepared to be asked for money for whatever you have. And sometimes you're not willing to do that. Sometimes it's not wise for you to give them what they ask, just like it's not always wise for us to give our children all the things that they ask for. That issue and the begging that is very common among the poor people there, not only the poor people, but sometimes the not-so-poor-poor people, begging itself is an acceptable behavior. And a beggar is considered to have a respectable job, lifestyle. So that is viewed differently from our perspective. And that, I think those two things are two of the things that cause the biggest continual turmoil within ourselves as far as trying to represent Christ and trying to be loving and to be aware of the need that they honestly do have, but to look beyond the meeting of that very immediate little need and to do something more long-term to help them in a more long-term way. It's a struggle that has been very difficult. We've asked people who have been in Haiti for some time, does this ever get better? And they say no. You never, unless you really turn yourself off and just put up a wall that you will not listen to or not be touched by the need, there's always the turmoil about the person who asks, is it a real need? Are you doing them good by meeting that need, or are you really not helping them? Are you creating some kind of a dependence that will turn around and backfire, that will make them resent you? It's really complicated issues, and it's one of the things that makes us grow while we're in Haiti, too. Question about where we live in our lifestyle. The mission that we work for had already had housing built, and it's extremely nice, very adequate housing, cinder block buildings. We have indoor plumbing. I have absolutely no complaints about our living quarters at all. We cook with propane. We have gas stoves. We have gas refrigerators. So we do have refrigeration. Electricity for the housing that we live in, we are hooked up with the generator that runs at the hospital, which is about 2 blocks down the hill. So in the daytime, when the hospital is in function, there is a generator running for electricity, and we also have electricity at what we call the White House, because our house is painted white, and it's this big house that sits on the hill. It's actually an apartment house with 5 apartments in it. Unfortunately, most of us are at work during the day, so we don't get to use the electricity at the apartments. When we first came to Dessalines, the city of Dessalines also has a generator that sits outside of town as you enter. It provides electricity from approximately 6 o'clock at night, or when it starts to get dark, about dusk, it will come on. And it usually lasts, they'll run it until about 1 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, and then most people are down for the night, and that provides lighting for them in their houses during the evening hours. This past summer, we went on vacation. We got back to Dessalines. We had one night of electricity from the city generator, and then it quit. And after 2 weeks of no electricity at night, I started asking around what was going on and why we didn't have electricity, and found out that a part was broken on the Delco, the generator. And so as soon as that part got back, it could be fixed and then we'd be going again. We got it fixed, supposedly, and the coup occurred. And then everything started going haywire again. So we haven't had nighttime electricity for a long time. And we're learning to be like Abraham Lincoln, I guess, and use kerosene lamps. I don't know how he did it. There's an open air market twice a week, and people from the hillsides and the surrounding areas bring their produce to sell. We have a good variety of vegetables and fruits. The thing we do lack is green leafy vegetables. There are only a couple kinds, and one of them is watercress, and I'm not real crazy about that because it's kind of bitter, but it's edible. But we really, we don't have lack of, we have quite adequate variety of diet. The foods that are there are available to, you know, all the Haitian people, and really they're quite, well, I'd say they're quite reasonable, but if you're feeding a family of 10 twice a day, well, you don't feed them twice a day. You're lucky if you get them fed once a day, actually. That does add up. What else can I tell you about where we live?
Do we want to tell them about a little bit about the political situation? it's kind of complicated. I don't know how far we could get into it, but... Do you want to share about that?
Well, just briefly, Aristide, who is a ex-priest from the Catholic Church in Haiti, he's been politically active and politically a voice for quite a few years now, and has been very much against the governments in power who exploit the Haitian people and rip off any monies, foreign aids that are received. They very seldom ever make it down to the people that they're intended to get to because of corrupt governments, leaders at the top. Anyway, Aristide was one of the candidates for what was billed as the first democratic elections, the first free elections. And he was overwhelmingly the people's choice, the people being the majority in the countryside, the poor people. He was elected, I think it was in December of 1990.
Something like 70% of the people voted for him.
There was great hope in the people, not only in Aristide's ideas and his person, but in this idea that they were finally going to have a free election. And I was a little bit apprehensive because they have such great expectations for this man. I don't know that anybody could fulfill the role they expected him to do. Looked upon him almost as a savior, in my opinion. That's just before he was to be inaugurated in February, there was an attempted coup, and I'm not sure how much of that got up here for news of that. At that time, there was, in the town where we live and in Port-au-Prince and everywhere, tires were burning in every intersection. That is a common form of protest to let you know they're unhappy about something. Black smoke was coming up all over the city of Dessalines, and the people were very vocal about it. Then when September 30th, when we woke up that morning and heard that there had been an actual coup, and Aristide had been removed from the country, we didn't see any of the tires burning. There was a very subdued atmosphere, and I asked one of our Haitian staff in the hospital, why don't I see the tires burning? Where's the protest that happened the last time? And he said the military will not allow it. So along with this coup, there was very much military repression on anybody speaking out. It was not allowed. Indiscriminate killing of people going into slums, shooting people down by the army. And yet the army said that they didn't want control, they simply didn't want Aristide in control. And so they did not say, we the army are now in control, and it was very nebulous for a long time, and I think it kind of still is, who is in control.
Apparently the army was paid money by the a group in Haiti known as the elite. That there's a very small rich minority that were anti-Aristide because he was for the poor and policies that would help the poor, and this group paid the military to get rid of Aristide, and so they were behind it. And so why don't you?
But go ahead. Take your time.
So after this coup happened, there were some that wanted to kill him, I understand, but he managed to escape, as he had many times in the past. There had been many attempts on his life, and many of the people almost worship him because they think he has special powers. There had been something like six or eight times people had tried killing him, and the bullets never did hit him. They always missed when they would fire at him. And many of the people feel like he's almost he's got special powers. But anyway, he left Haiti, and many of the surrounding countries were quite upset with this because this was the first democratically elected president in the history of Haiti. And he's been overthrown, and many South American countries felt that if democracy could be overthrown with a coup like this in Haiti. Well, it could happen in their country too. So they wanted Aristide reinstated. And so the Organization of American States, which is the organization of countries in the Western Hemisphere, decided to put on an embargo to force Haiti to reinstate Aristide. And so that embargo has been in place for several months. It hasn't brought about its desired effect. Many thought that it would harm only the rich and the people that were trying to rule the country, but it has caused a lot of hardship for the people throughout Haiti. The cost of food has gone up. Availability of transportation is just very difficult to. There isn't gasoline or diesel to fuel vehicles, so people can't ship their goods into Port-au-Prince to be sold, and so it's caused all kinds of hardship, and medical care is much more difficult to obtain because many of the foreigners who've been involved in providing medical care have been forced to leave. The embassy recommended, the American embassy recommended that Americans leave at the time we left. And the hospital we were involved in, we turned over to the Haitians, so it is still functioning, but many other hospitals are closed because of the situation. And so the people are under a real hardship during this time. This is a real concern to us, and we hope this situation will be settled soon, but there is sort of a stalemate on, and it's not clear how long it's going to go on. There's talk of military intervention, but the United States is very reluctant to do that because they had been in Haiti for something like 20 years, but in the 20s and 30s, trying to reestablish suitable government without much success. Eventually, the U.S. left Haiti, and the Haitians still remember that time, and they have sort of a negative attitude towards America, feeling like we came in and to run their country and as dictators, and so there is the United States is rather reluctant to be involved militarily in Haiti. It's a difficult situation, and I would appreciate your prayers about it because many people are suffering because of what's going on there. We hope that it will stabilize and that we'll be able to go back and continue the work we were involved in.
This was last February, that coup?
The coup happened in September 30th, 1991, so that's been about 5 months, something like that. Let's see, we left around November 1st, about a month after it happened. And so it's November, December, January. 3 months since we left, about 4 months since the coup.
In the United States, Haitians are considered a really high risk for AIDS. Is AIDS something that you see in your practice in Haiti?
Yes, Haiti is very similar to in regards to AIDS, it's very similar to Africa. AIDS is transmitted in Africa predominantly heterosexually, and that's the way it is in Haiti too. There's a lot of other sexually transmitted diseases, such as syphilis and herpes with ulcerated lesions, which are a port of entry for the AIDS virus, HIV virus. And working in the hospital, we would diagnose maybe 7 new AIDS cases a week on the average. And it's very difficult to deal with these people or to tell them that they have, either they have full-blown AIDS or maybe they're, usually we would do the test, the blood test for AIDS when there would be symptoms of AIDS. And so most of them were sick when we would diagnose it. But it is a really serious problem in Haiti.
Do we know how AIDS got to Haiti? I mean, where it predated its entrance to the United States? Or is there any And I realize some records probably.
I've heard different stories. There's a theory that there were some Haitian teachers that went to Zaire that brought it back after contacting prostitutes in Zaire. Somebody's idea for how it got there, but I
don't know for sure.
There's a lot of sexual immorality, promiscuity in Haiti, and it doesn't seem like the AIDS scare has changed it a lot either. Condoms are readily available, but not very many people use them. It's just hard to get them to practice preventative kinds of things, to understand the...
You then are sponsored by your church, is it that? Or is it an organization separate from the church?
I guess I didn't explain that. I'm sorry. Haiti Medical Teams is a non-denominational organization, but some of the people that were involved in starting this Haiti Medical Teams were Free Methodists, and when the hospital was built, they needed a sponsorship, and so the Free Methodist Church is sponsoring the hospital and the Dessalines Rural Health Project. You know.
Did they send out other crews? Other than the medical crews,
other
than
eight people who are sick? At times we have work teams that come to help some of the maintenance and upkeep of the facilities. Mostly we have specialty teams, like surgery teams, that will come and we'll schedule surgery cases ahead. So that we've had gynecologists and general surgeons come and some nurses to help them. And we have those kind of teams coming every once in a while.
Are most teams that go in say, a short-term team?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is about what length of time?
2 weeks, usually.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe some of U.S. economic interest in Haiti and corporate presence? What is that like?
I don't feel like we really know that much about that. I know that there are many factories in Port-au-Prince who do low-cost labor things for clothing. I know baseballs is a big deal. I believe there are circuit board type factories working too. That's really, we're there in a different area to where we really don't have that much exposure to know what is really going on there. So I don't know how great that is.
I think the political situation scared off most of the industry from Haiti.
At the time of the coup and then the embargo, there was another date given, and it seems to me it was December 5th, that there was word out that all of the American factories should have all of their goods and their people out by that time. So that... the fact that those factories have closed down has also increased immensely the economic hardship for the people in Port-au-Prince. They didn't make much, but now they make nothing.
Is there a form of mass communication? Do they have a television station in Port-au-Prince or a radio station?
Yeah, there is a television station. When you're in Port-au-Prince and you have a TV, you can pick it up. There's also cable TV, and so you can get CNN and Sports Network and, you know, all this stuff. There is, what about, 4 or so radio stations. One of them is administered through the people who run it are also through our Free Methodist group. Goodness, I can't remember.
Radio Lumiere.
But there is the radio, there's the national radio, and I can't think what that's called. There's
Radio Sola. That's a Catholic radio station. And then there's
okay. There's a few radio stations. They are pretty much, if they start talking about things the government doesn't want, such as happened during the coup, they come in and shoot them up.
That was my next question.
Yeah.
Yeah, they closed down all the radio stations during political coups and things like that. Usually everything's closed down.
No speech at all.
Not really.
No.
Mm-hmm. How about voodoo?
What
can you talk about voodoo?
Yeah. Well, they say that majority of the main religion in Haiti is voodoo. A lot of people on the surface are Catholic, but they practice voodoo, and there's sort of an intermixture of Catholicism and voodoo. Many of the holidays are the Catholics and voodoo people celebrate together with different, they have different names for voodoo saints and instead of Catholic saints, and they've kind of
merged the two of them and kind of hidden the voodoo under the umbrella of Catholicism. And so the holidays that are Catholic holidays, the real voodoo practitioners celebrate those same, and they know that when we're having holiday for St. Thomas, it's really holiday for the voodoo, whatever. It's there very much, and even voodoo has been a part of the Haitian culture clear back from its African roots, that even if a person comes out of voodoo and into some form of Christianity, those roots are very hard, those superstitions and those fears in their lives are very hard to break. And so often you'll see covering all the bases. You know, we'll go to church, we'll go do our prayers, and we'll go put the little foods out for the gods too.
Offer sacrifices.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's very much there. And there's such a fear that is part of voodoo. That's just part of the religion. It's very much fear control that's hard to break.
They have a voodoo festival in Dessalines every year, and we were glad we weren't there the last time they had it. We were on vacation the last time, because it just people from voodoo Ugans from all over Haiti descend, and they sell all their wares in the streets, and it's a, I don't know, it's just we had a team surgery team during that time, and I don't know, there was a very, it just seemed like an oppressive presence. It seemed like there was so much evil in the town, and we're such a small force combating all the evil, and we were trying to, a number of the cases that we were trying to do, everything just seemed to go wrong, and it was really weird. It just, anyway, I think there's a real forces of evil involved in voodoo.
You almost sense it. Evil that goes with it.
Yeah.
It's a known fact that Duvalier, when he was there, was very much into voodoo. The leaders that are in government have always wanted to try to appease the Protestant churches, the Catholic Church, and the voodoo faction, too. It's always been, they want to, just like any politician, be appealing and okayed by everybody. And I believe, if I remember, that when Aristide first came out, he gave the impression that he was very much against the voodoo. And then when he was in, little things started to come in that let you know that perhaps he wasn't as against voodoo as you first thought he was. And I really don't know how much, I wouldn't even begin to say how much, you know, he's into voodoo, but I personally think there's a little bit of it there.
There's stories that some of the voodoo practitioners were allowed in the what is the main Capitol building? I don't remember that.
The Palace.
The National Palace. And even Duvalier hadn't done that. So that's...
Can you talk about what is the fear and what is the evil? What is the...
A voodoo?
What's the substance of that religion?
Well, I'm not any expert on voodoo, and on Haiti medical teams, we're advised to just not get all real curious about it, and try to just find out all you can. We're just told it's better just to finding out more about things evil and getting curious about evil things is not maybe a healthy curiosity, but. Essentially, I think it's a worship of Satan, offering sacrifices to Satan and praying to Satan, and they're voodoo priests that offer sacrifices to Satan and curses on people that, and it's believed in very strongly by the people, and there, I think satanic forces are at work in the practice of voodoo. And they're real. There's a doctor on our staff that has a relative that's been a voodoo practitioner, and he strongly believes in it. He's an educated man, and he's frightened. He had his friends tell him, "Why are you going to Dessalines? This is a center of voodoo. You're crazy. It's a dangerous place to go." And so it's real.
And it said that they kill people in Dessalines, and the remark had come back, "Well, we don't have murders." And he says, "No, you kill. They get killed other ways." It's a fear of death, and it's very real that you will be killed if you don't. I don't know. We don't know enough about it, and I'm agree with Jerry that. Curiosity has to be held. You have to do that very carefully. And if you're not prepared for what you might find, you better be very careful about it. But just to know that it is a very real force. We, in our language study, we made a relationship, an acquaintance with a fellow who lived up the street, and we would go a couple times, three times a week or so, and talk with him a little bit. We tried to ease into the thing about voodoo and try to get a little bit what his, you know, a Haitian's perspective on it and try to find out just a little bit more about it. He was from a Catholic background, but I believe his Catholicism was a little bit different than the typical Catholicism, and I found out later that he most likely is what they call a charismatic Catholic. But he told us very much, he was very adamant and would, on more than one occasion, said, "Don't get mixed up in voodoo, don't have anything to do with it." He said, it is a lie. It tells you from the front that I'm a wonderful thing and I will do good things for you, and as soon as you receive it, it turns around and stabs you in the back and kills you. And he was just adamant, just stay away from it, it is bad, there's nothing good about it. And those were his words, that it will turn around and stab you in the back and kill you. Mm-hmm.